This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 168, Xerxes, Arsaces, and Beyond. Last time, we covered the reign and fall of Achaeus, a cousin of the Seleucid royal family who declared himself king and briefly ruled over Anatolia while contesting the reign of Antiochus III. While Antiochus dealt with Molon's revolt in Media and Babylon, and conducted the Fourth Syrian War, Achaeus became embroiled in several local disputes around his own borders, and fought against King Attalus I of Pergamon. Then, in 214 BCE, Antiochus III, allied with Attalus, marched through Anatolia, besieged Sardis, and executed his rebellious cousin in truly gruesome fashion. We also covered the political geography of late 3rd century Anatolia, and how Antiochus centralized power in that region under a loyal satrap. His favorite general, named Zeuxis, and a religious cult dedicated to members of the Seleucid family. In 212, once the political situation in Seleucid Anatolia had settled, Antiochus prepared his army to march east for another campaign, which is where we will pick up today. Antiochus III began this eastward march. Antiochus III began this eastward march of conquest in a potentially surprising place, not even leaving the geographic confines of Anatolia before finding a new enemy to conquer in Armenia. That said, I should probably explain a bit here, because as I have said many times before, Armenia in antiquity means very different things from Armenia today. The modern Republic of Armenia in the Caucasus Mountains is a rump state, all that remains of the Armenian people's once extensive political and cultural reach after centuries of conflict and genocide, most notably at the hands of the Ottoman Turkish nationalists in the early 20th century. Until relatively recently, the name Armenia encompassed the entire mountainous eastern quarter of modern Turkey, and for a long time it extended into the center of Anatolia. the Hellenistic Armenian king Arsames constructed a city in his own name, Arsamosata, near the mouth of the Aristani River, or the Murat in Turkish, right at the intersection where it joins the Euphrates. It's not clear just how far west of the Euphrates Armenian authority extended in the early Hellenistic period. Eventually, it would reach all the way to Cilicia, but the Seleucids do seem to have controlled a wider corridor through the Taurus Mountains in Antiochus's time, though a dispute over that territory would at least provide a partial explanation for this campaign. Generally speaking, though, the core of westward Armenian power at this time was the northernmost part of Mesopotamia, between the sources of the Tigris and Euphrates River in central Anatolia. This region was called Sofene, a name likely derived from the ethnic group that lived there in the very early Iron Age. It's not at all clear how Armenia was administered at this time either. Greater Armenia, meaning the territory roughly east of the Tigris and a bit north of the Euphrates tributaries, roughly corresponded to the old Achaemenid satrapy, both in terms of geography and political control. The royal family of Armenia were still the descendants of Satrap Orontes I, who had been appointed by Artaxerxes II almost 200 years earlier. We don't know who exactly was king in 212 BCE, though. During Antiochus Hyrax's revolt, it was Arsames. A few years later, after Antiochus III's invasion, it was Anorontes IV. There's some coinage that may indicate an Arsames II in between the two, but it's not well preserved enough to rule out just being a different portrait of Arsames I. And assuming he was young in Hyrax's time and getting old by Antiochus III. It's also not clear just how Sofene was related to Greater Armenia at this point, because Polybius does record the king that Antiochus defeated at Arsamosata, and it was neither Arsames nor Orontes. Instead, it was a ruler by another Achaemenid name we have not heard in a long time. King Xerxes of Arsamosata, or Xerxes of Sofene, depending on how he is described. This was apparently a son of Arsames I and ruler of some portion of the kingdom's western territory, probably a younger son or brother to the current king of Armenia. Given that Xerxes is called a king by Polybius, he may have been in a dispute with Arsames II or Orontes IV, or that could just be inaccuracy on Polybius's part. We don't know what form this conflict took, if there were battles or if Antiochus's army just marched right up to Arsamosata and besieged Armenia's westmost provincial capital, though that did happen eventually. Antiochus justified his aggression on the basis that Arsames I, Xerxes' father, had owed tribute of some sort to the Seleucids and stopped paying the rightful king when he chose to support Hyrax in the civil war. Ideologically, this assault on Arsamosata was another example of Antiochus enforcing his will on a rebellious vassal. Practically, seizing control of Sofene would expand Seleucid access into Anatolia at a time when the corridor between Syria and the northern provinces was hemmed in to just a couple of mountain passes. Seleucid troops quickly took the city walls and moved their siege right up to Xerxes' fortified palace, at which point Xerxes opened negotiations to surrender. Most of Antiochus's advisors suggested just continuing the siege, conquering the city outright, and annexing the territory. Antiochus had an easier plan. He negotiated a very favorable deal out of Xerxes, who would pay a discounted version of the tribute his father had neglected, and ally with the Seleucids. And in exchange, he would also marry Antiochus III's sister, Antiochus. Xerxes' tribute, 300 talents of silver, 1,000 horses, and 1,000 mules, would have immediately been integrated into Antiochus's further preparations for war. If Xerxes was blamed for his father's failure to pay tribute, that was nothing compared to the wholly separatist kingdoms that had emerged further east, Parthia and Bactria. Sadly, this section of Polybius's histories is fragmentary. We don't know much about Antiochus III's preparations for this war, but from Sophene, he probably went back to the Seleucids in Syria before heading to Babylon with his army, his military advisors, and his eldest son. The crown prince was also named Antiochus, and he was only about 12 years old at this time, but he was still the eldest. And Antiochus III officially appointed his son as co-king. The younger Antiochus would remain in Seleucia on the Tigris, presumably in the care of less military-minded royal advisors and the local satrap, while the actual king led his army northeast through Media. By the winter between 210 and 209, Antiochus and his men had taken up residence in and around the Median capital at Ecbatana. And in one last push to make sure his army would be fully paid and compliant as they undertook a difficult campaign, Antiochus confiscated a temple treasury in the city to the tune of some 4,000 talents, or 114 tons of gold and silver bullion before heading out in the spring and on to Parthia. We last heard from the newfound kingdom of Parthia when the formerly nomadic warlord Arsaces I repelled an invasion by Seleucus II in the mid-230s. By that time, Arsaces had already carved Parthia and Hyrcania away from Seleucid rule and had been busy in the intervening decades. Arsaces is credited with the foundation of several new cities and towns, or at least renaming and expanding some existing settlements. Most importantly, this included Nisa, a grand palace complex and accompanying town in modern Turkmenistan, built in a fusion of Iranian cultural tradition and Hellenistic style, with statues and reliefs identifiable as traditional depictions of Greek gods, taking on new roles as Zoroastrian Yazada, a common occurrence in post-Hellenistic Iranian art. This hybrid culture is also evident in the coinage minted under Arsaces I, presenting himself in a similar headdress to old Achaemenid satraps who minted their own coinage in Anatolia, or to his Fraudaraka contemporaries down in Persis. Especially similar to the latter, by depicting a Hellenistic-style diadem tied around his head on the obverse side of the coins. However, Arsaces was depicted as clean-shaven in typical Seleucid style, and the reverse side is a clear, deliberate Iranization of Seleucid designs. The most common reverse image on Seleucid coinage was an image of the god Apollo, heroically nude as the Greeks often depicted their gods, holding a bow in right hand and sitting on the omphalos, a stone plinth used as a seat by Apollo's most famous oracle in the Greek city of Delphi. Arsaces replaced this with an Iranian figure. If not himself, then a figure with his own prominent nose and beardless chin, wearing a traditional Saka cap and a kandis, the so-called Median robe of Achaemenid art with long loose sleeves. And this figure is seated on a stool in the style of Achaemenid satrap's coinage instead of the omphalos. However, Arsaces I died before Antiochus made his march to the east. When precisely, we do not know, but most modern estimates guess only a few years earlier. According to the ancient historian Arrian, Arsaces actually died almost immediately, and most of the events ascribed to him belong to his brother Tiridates I. However, if Tiridates existed, there is no numismatic or other archaeological evidence for him. And most ancient sources go straight from Arsaces I to his son, Arsaces II. In the same intervening period between Seleucus II and Antiochus III, Parthia's relationship with its eastern neighbors had apparently deteriorated. At the same time that Arsaces I was establishing his own kingdom, Diodotus II seceded from Seleucid control and established the Greco-Bactrian kingdom in Bactria and at least parts of Margiana, Sogdia, and Aria. When Seleucus II attempted to reclaim these separatist kingdoms, they allied with one another to fend him off. But by around 225 BCE, the Greco-Bactrian state became embroiled in its own civil war as a noble named Euthydemus fought to seize power for himself. He besieged the capital at Icanum and overthrew Diodotus, declaring himself the new king, and Euthydemus I had no love for the Parthians. So when Antiochus III arrived, he was not only a much more successful military leader than his father had been, but his opponent, Arsaces II, was comparatively inexperienced and had no local allies to speak of. We don't know much about either army. Based on the few figures that are referenced and other armies led by Antiochus, John D. Granger estimates a Seleucid force of about 35,000 men, including at least 6,000 cavalry, about 15,000 heavy infantry, 12,000 light, and 2,000 archers. We know a little bit more about Antiochus's inner circle of generals and commanders. For example, the Cretan archers were apparently recruited by a Rhodian mercenary called Polyxenidas. Diogenes, who was officially the satrap of Susiana and had commanded the Seleucid navy, was now leading the archers and slingers. And most interestingly of all, Nicolaus of Aetolia, who had commanded the Ptolemaic forces against Antiochus throughout the Fourth Syrian War, had now sold his services to the other side and commanded the light infantry. Arsaces was slow to respond to this approaching host. Antiochus had to march through the outer edges of Iran's northern deserts to reach Parthia. And the Parthian defenders attempted to fill in the wells and block off the underground Khanat water chambers that supplied the region. But they were too slow. A Seleucid cavalry detachment raced ahead of the main force to secure the water sources and chase off the Parthians sent to secure them. It is possible that the Parthian withdrawal was supposed to be a feigned retreat, one of the Parthians' favorite tactics, but that only works if the enemy chases you into hostile terrain or reinforcements. And the Seleucid cavalry simply secured the wells and waited for Antiochus to catch up with the rest of the army. Polybius presents this as Arsaces not believing that Antiochus would actually invade. That seems exceptionally unlikely to me, given that he had already subdued Atropatene at this point, making Parthia the only place for a king with 35,000 soldiers to go from Ecbatana. More likely, Arsaces expected the Seleucids to follow the same route as Alexander the Great, crossing the rougher, more hospitable Alborz Mountains and invading Hyrcania first. Instead, Antiochus surprised his opponent by sweeping south, through the desert, and up into Parthia proper. As a result of this route, Antiochus not only faced relatively little resistance beside the skirmish over the irrigation system, but he was able to approach the Parthian administrative capital of Hecatompylos, near modern Semnon, and find it all but undefended. Literally meaning the City of 100 Gates, Hecatompylos' name was probably a slight exaggeration. But it reflected its place as a hub of administration and trade on the borders between arid central Iran, the mountainous west, and the open plains of central Asia. In this time and place, all roads led to Hecatompylos, and each led into the city through its own gate. It was an ideal place for Antiochus and his army to rest, resupply, and prepare for their next move. A next move which must have left the Greco-Macedonian-style tacticians and strategists of the Seleucid high command perplexed, if confident. In typical Mediterranean and West Asian warfare as the Seleucids knew it, nobody just abandoned a city as valuable and defensible as Hecatompylos. In their style of pitched battles and sieges, that was all but suicidal. The Parthians, still using and expanding on the tactics of semi-nomadic steppe raiders, were much more skilled in a different form of warfare. Rather than trying to draw out pitched battles or assault well-fortified cities, they operated on a strategic plan of feigned retreats, ambushes, encirclement, and harassment. More of their army was made up of cavalry than a typical Hellenistic force, and that put speed and maneuverability on their side. The Parthians preferred to draw out the enemy force in smaller sections, overextend their supply lines by chasing after the withdrawing Parthian army, and harass that supply line until the campaign was either untenable or the opposing army was weakened enough to take head-on. To that end, Arsaces took his army out of Parthia altogether and occupied Hyrcania, on the southeastern shores of the Caspian Sea. This would require Antiochus to cross the Alborz Mountains anyway, and further west than if he had just taken the direct route into Hyrcania from Media. Polybius says that the main pass in this time went by a mountain he calls Libanus. Based on location, I would guess that this is one of the mountains along the road between modern Damghan and Mazandaran province. Historically, this pass was fortified and fought over many times, most famously by the medieval Hashashin Order, aka the Assassins. For 8 days, Antiochus's forces marched in a long, narrow column through the Alborz, and Parthian outposts, or perhaps local militias of mountain dwellers commanded by the Parthians, attacked them and tried to barricade the pass as they marched. To combat this, Diogenes and Nicolaus of Aetolia commanded the light infantry in front of the main army, moving swiftly to skirmish or return arrow and sling fire along the way. Diogenes led a detachment of the most lightly equipped soldiers off the main path and onto the surrounding hillsides and cliffs to drive off the Parthian defenders. Finally, they reached the main pass of Mount Labanus itself, and found Arsaces II there with the bulk of his army waiting to hold the gap. The Parthians apparently deployed an infantry formation of their own against the Seleucid phalanx. And so much as they could in the narrow landscape, the cavalry made hit-and-run attacks, but they were significantly outnumbered. And the Seleucid light infantry was sent up the surrounding slopes to flank the Parthian defenders. At risk of becoming encircled themselves, the Parthians retreated. Or at least, that's the traditional story. In the book Rain of Arrows, Nicolaus Overtoun suggests a more favorable view of Parthian tactics. In the best-case scenario, even Arsaces II knew he was outnumbered, and he may have been hoping to either disrupt the Seleucid phalanx on rough terrain, or lead them into a feigned retreat and catch them unprepared on the mountain roads north of Mount Labas. Instead, as the Seleucid light infantry began flanking the Parthian army, Arsaces ordered a retreat, but Antiochus did not order a pursuit. Instead, he got his troops back in formation and prepared for a slow but orderly descent onto the coastal plains. There was a palace complex at the northern end of this march called Tambrax. It's not clear whose palace this was. It might have been an old Achaemenid governor's residence that was still in use by the new Parthian nobility, a Seleucid palace with the same story, or something newly constructed for the Arsacids. Whatever the case, it was the first large settlement Antiochus reached, and it was completely unfortified. So the Seleucid army seized it and used it as a base camp to recuperate from the arduous mountain trek and take advantage of the many supplies stored inside Tambrax. Given that he had effectively surrendered most of his kingdom to Antiochus by refusing to fight a field battle or a siege, Arsaces had to change his tactics at this point. The Parthian army was too small to take the Seleucids in an open field, but they could potentially hold out in an exhausting siege. So at least some of the Parthian army pulled back to the nearest city of Syrinx, the administrative capital of Hyrcania, which was heavily fortified. A strong wall surrounded the city, and beyond that there were three dry moats, about 14 meters wide and 7 deep, and each moat had a wooden fortification in front of it as well. The Seleucid forces constructed portable barriers like medieval siege mantlets to shield small groups of soldiers and workmen as they approached each successive layer of fortification and fought for control. Once they had taken a section of the wooden palisade, they would then have to either fill in the next moat or build a bridge across to assault the next palisade, all the while Parthian defenders fired arrows and threw whatever burning or crushing ammunition they could find down on the attacking army. Polybius suggests that this assault lasted for weeks of near constant fighting, with different sections of the palisade and the moat falling at various times, and neither side able to collect their dead and wounded in the chaos of unending combat. When the Seleucids finally reached the walls of Syrinx, they could not scale them. But the 7-meter-deep moat did provide an opportunity to undermine them, literally. The word undermine comes from medieval siegecraft. Attacking armies would dig under the walls of a fortress, and likewise, the defenders would countermine, intercepting the attackers with their own tunnels. And Polybius tells us that the Battle of Syrinx even spread into this subterranean theater. Basically, Arsaces and his men put up one hell of a fight, but Antiochus's army was better prepared, better equipped, and more numerous. Eventually, a few of those mines broke through, and the gates were thrown open by the Seleucid soldiers that made it inside Syrinx. Supposedly, the Parthian soldiers massacred the Greek residents, and once again tried a feigned retreat. It apparently worked in part this time. A contingent of the Seleucid army chased the Parthians as they fled. Then Arsaces' forces turned around and charged back into Syrinx as the Seleucids pillaged, only to be attacked again by the Seleucid light infantry and forced to surrender outright. Again, these sections of Polybius's writing are only fragmentary, so we do not know what resistance, if any, Arsaces II offered after the siege of Syrinx. However, Justin does make a brief reference to Antiochus forming an alliance with Arsaces in the aftermath of their war. So not only did the Parthian king escape the gruesome traitor's execution faced by Achaeus and Molon, but he was apparently granted some sort of vassal status, similar to King Artabanus in Atropatene and Xerxes in Sophene. We don't know if Arsaces was allowed to keep all of his territory, or if it was split between him and whatever governor Antiochus left behind in Hecatompylos, but the kingdom of Parthia survived in a weakened state nonetheless, with an obligation to provide tribute and military support to the Seleucids. But there is no rest for a conquering king. And like Cyrus the Younger or Alexander the Great, Antiochus had embarked on his Anabasis with a goal in mind: the reconquest of all of his forefathers' lost territory. To that end, once his army was sufficiently rested and resupplied, the Seleucid king turned his attention eastward once again and headed for Bactria. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conqueror's Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.